So, the recorders I've got for us all to have a play with today are a variety. The one we're using to record this podcast is the Zoom H1, which is on a little tripod here. Another cheap recorder, we've got a few of these, is the Tascam DR05. You know the sort of thing. It looks like this. It records onto a memory card, and you can connect it to a computer using a USB cable. And rather like a digital camera, you can drag and drop, copy and paste files from this onto the computer. Each recorder has its own particular quirks, and you can use external microphones with a lot of these things. So at the back of the room in its box, which is the Marantz 661, I'll show you photographs of all these. There we go. We've got a couple of those, the Zoom H4N at the back. What differentiates the cheaper recorders from the more expensive ones? Well, there's a certain, you know, the quality of the electronics inside may be one thing, but actually, practically, it's do the more expensive recorders accept expensive microphones? Well, you can plug them in. And these are used what are called XLR connections, which actually they're in a box down in the office at the moment. They're three-pronged. They connect in and they don't come out, but this doesn't have the correct inputs. So that's broadly the difference. The more expensive ones have inputs which accept high-quality microphones. With these, you either use the built-in microphones or you use a slightly lower-quality microphone that has a smaller connection. It can still be good quality, though. And if you're on a budget, if you don't have a vast amount of money, the cheaper recorders do a perfectly good job. What I don't recommend, and what no one in the field recommends, are cheaper digital voice recorders that sell for about £35 to £55. Oh. There are a variety of reasons. I mean, they're okay. Don't get me wrong. They're not a disaster by any stretch. Students use them a lot. Yeah, they're fine. They're fine. Generally, for archival purposes, you want uncompressed CD quality or better files. It's just generally thought that there's a better chance of being able to read these in years to come.
Yeah. Okay.
The cheaper voice recorders usually don't record at that quality. You're getting some sort of compressed file, usually. Sometimes it's a Sony file or an Olympus file, which only Sony software or Olympus software can read back. That's not good, because there's absolutely no guarantee that that software will still be around in 10 or 15 years' time.
There's a guarantee it won't.
Well, I guarantee it won't, as someone just said. Yep.
What does uncompressed mean? I'm sorry.
Well, I often use photographs, actually, so the analogy with this.
Yes.
With photographs, you've probably all used a digital camera at some point. The average camera takes JPEG photographs.
Yeah.
But the professional will use TIFF or RAW photographs because it doesn't lose any information. The JPEG has jettisoned a lot of information that it considers to be unnecessary to create a smaller, more manageable file.
Okay.
And it looks great.
Yeah.
You can edit it once or twice, but then it begins to fray a bit. Whereas the TIFF, or the raw image, you can edit as many times as you like, and it doesn't deteriorate. Similarly with sound, the MP3s that everybody listens to on their iPods and all the rest of it, for speech particularly, you won't be able to tell the difference. But you can only edit it a couple of times before you start to hear deterioration. And archivally, well, MP3 is such a well-established format at the moment, but is there a guarantee that we'll still be able to hear it back in 20 years' time? Everything digital is hedging your bets at the moment about what you are most likely to be able to hear back in future. And, of course, as new technologies come along, you try and migrate from one thing to another. I don't know what the next sea change in technology is going to be, but with uncompressed information, okay, recorded at good quality, you've got a better chance of moving that into other formats.
So 50 years from now, it would still be accessible and people could do stuff with it, we hope.
We hope. Even if these files aren't accessible in 50 years' time, you hope you've transferred them into something that will be.
Okay.
But you've also transferred the high-quality original file rather than the lower-quality original file. So, yes?
How would we recognise an uncompressed
file? WAV. It's short for WAV. I call it WAV. It's a WAV file. All of these recorders record WAV or WAV files. CD quality is 44.1 kilohertz, 16-bit information. It's a number at the end of the day. The 44.1 kilohertz could also be 48 kilohertz, it could be 96 kilohertz. This is a frequency of sampling rate. You can have 16-bit, 24-bit. All CDs are recorded at 44.1 kilohertz, 16-bit. That's the minimum that these things record at. They will also record MP3 files as well. If you're not in any way technologically inclined, the main thing is just to set these things on their default setting, which is CD quality, WAV files, and you'll be fine. And that will work well. You can, if you want to, record at higher quality, should you want to.
Sorry to interrupt you again, but so will you, when you finish this bit of the presentation, recommend one to us, say, under £500 at the moment?
I
know you're not you're not being sponsored by anybody, as far as I know, but for, as somebody who's not very technological, it's very helpful for you to say, well, if you've got a budget of under £500, I'd recommend you to go for this.
All right, I will give you my thoughts on that in a moment, then. Yeah.
Thank you very much. That would be very helpful.
Well, the thing is, there are actually a lot of recorders out there. To play with at the back of the room, we've got the Zoom H4Ns, which are highly thought of because they're a good compromise between high quality and price. Let's face it, price is always an issue. Round about 275, maybe down to 250. They accept good quality microphones and make good quality recordings. Mark II, that's new. Right, okay. This, as you can see, is more expensive. We've got one of these at the back of the room, Mark I, I think, at the back of the room. Isn't that typical? You go and buy something, and a few weeks later, they bring out the new improved version. Don't you love digital stuff? High quality, but expensive. Yes?
Microphones. I mean, you talk about microphones, but what do you refer to as being a high-quality microphone?
I'm going to go by price, generally £100 upwards.
Yeah, but in terms of variety, I mean, I use the large diaphragm Phantom mics. Well, do they give Phantom L?
Yes.
If they don't, then you can't use Phantom mics.
No, well, I'm trying to avoid getting into technical stuff too much. The more expensive recorders all give out Phantom power, which is to say they will charge microphones if microphones need a current to work. Some microphones have batteries in them, some take power from the recorder. The more expensive ones all will give out phantom power, as it's called, to microphones. I don't think there are any that don't. I may be wrong about that. So these will, they work better with certain microphones rather than others, but generally they all work well.
They all have inbuilt.
They all have inbuilt microphones as well. Yes. But I suppose if you're going for something that costs £300 upwards,
yes,
what's the point in getting it if you're not then going to use decent quality microphones?
I see. Okay.
Is my attitude to this. Others may disagree.
Because it'll make the recording better. Sorry, again, this is a basic question.
It will make the recording crisper and better, but to be honest with speech, you don't hear that difference too much, I don't think.
Right.
People may listen to this podcast and shoot me down on this.
I think the big difference is when you're editing and when you're trying to cut out background noise. On a lot of those handheld units, you do get a lot of background noise, and it's often quite difficult to get rid of that. Whereas when you're using large diaphragm mics, you can have the focal distance probably 6 or 8 inches away from the person talking. Therefore, anything else you don't get in the background.
That is true. I found with these, though, that there isn't so much noise that you can't edit them well, generally speaking. Actually, the Zoom may be slightly better than the Tascams for that. I'm just going to scroll down here and show you that there is a variety of stuff. For the purposes of oral history, these all do a pretty good job, to be honest. It's down to your budget. This is still the cheapest on the market, the Zoom H1. I was recommending this for a while if you're really on a budget. It suffers from handling noise a lot, so that's why this is on a little tripod. If you touch it, that comes out as a great big clunk on the recording. But I really like the quality of the recording you get from Zoom internal microphones. I think it's pretty good. Someone who does sound recording as a profession would say no, not good enough, possibly, but actually, for all intents and purposes, it's pretty good.
If no one is going to keep updating the type of file you've got every 25 years, and they're not, why are you recording something that costs £500?
It'll last a long time. It'll give you good quality recordings. You know, it's also very good for music. My attitude to this is, if you're spending money on one of these things, get a good one with good quality microphones. You can go out and record other things. It doesn't just have to be oral history. It can be wildlife, it can be music, it can be all sorts of things. So there's a good argument for getting a good quality recorder and buying some expensive microphones and all the rest. But for most groups, there is this thing about not wanting to spend hundreds and hundreds of pounds. The Tascam, I'm not completely convinced that the quality is as good as the cheap Zoom, but it's around about the same price. It doesn't suffer from the handling noise. You could do an interview like that with this. Wouldn't be able to do that with the Zoom. Also, the buttons are much easier to use. The buttons on the Zoom H1 are fiddly, if we're honest. This is very straightforward, I think, and easy to use.
So it's idiot-proof.
Fairly. It's always possible to leave it in pause rather than record, because it takes two presses of the red button to get this going. One puts it into pause, and the other sets it recording. So there's always the potential to make a mistake, always. There are other cheaper ones, the Zoom H2N, people like that. The Olympus make a couple of decent quality ones as well. And then you get the really, really expensive stuff as well. I mean, to be honest, I don't think it would be very difficult to recommend one that is absolutely head and shoulders above all the others. Well, I can. It costs £2,000, though. You know, there is a sound devices thing out there that is just the bee's knees, but you're not going to buy it. I'm not going to buy it. You know, there is stuff out there that's really good. In this price range, you won't go too far wrong with any of these. And for most people, it comes down to one with easy-to-use buttons, if we're honest. If you don't mind plugging in microphones and taking a greater interest in the device, then you could spend more, get some higher-quality microphones. A lot of groups I've met don't want to do that. And with these, you can get a decent recording by placing it in front of someone and letting them talk.
This is the Tascam.
This is any of the cheap ones.
Okay.
We'll do this.
But you're saying the Tascam is easier in terms of buttons.
It's simple and easy to use. Having said that, this is about £90 or whatever. There's a Tascam at about £150. Okay. There's a Zoom at about £150. I would go for the one that you think looks easiest to use.
Yes.
And to be fair to the Tascam range, they're all pretty simple and easy to use. And most of the Zooms are as well. It's just the Zoom H1 that has the tiny fiddly buttons. So I'm really going to sit on the fence as to what is the best and which is the worst here. People use a variety of microphones with these things. You can get tie-clip microphones if you're going to use separate microphones. These are commonly used, around about £100. They clip on. Obviously, with clip-on mics, there's always the danger of clothing brushing against them and things like that. But if you're careful, they come out well. You can use larger ones which are handheld or which you can place in a stand. And I know some oral historians do that. They carry a stand and they put the mic in a stand facing at people. The larger microphone, the handheld mic, will give you a better quality recording. Frankly, carrying a stand round with me and setting all up is more hassle than I need. I tend to use tie mics if I'm using them. Although a lot of the time I've been happy just using these smaller ones as well. At the moment, I'm doing a series of interviews using tie mics, and they're coming out fine. They're sounding good.
Is that a tie mic for you as well as the person you're interviewing, or is it just the person you're interviewing has the tie mic?
I tend to, myself, because I've got a loud voice, tend not to mic myself up, although a lot of projects will mic up the interviewer and the two people, one on each. And you have one on the left-hand side, one on the right-hand channel. So, yes, a lot of people do that, yeah. Of course, that's twice the expense on microphones, but the HLF will wear this. The HLF will pay for good quality recording equipment, although the ones at the back I'm about to hand out are available for loan as well.
Oh.
So there's a variety of microphones. They often need a cable to go with them as well, and they vary from £100 up to £180 for that one. You can get cheaper ones. This connection here, this one's about £30. That is the sort of thing that would fit into something like this. My experience with these has been that actually they're not really any different from using the internal microphones, or sometimes worse, but it varies. That's roughly what's available sound-wise. Some of you might be licking your lips at the thought of getting loads of kit. Others of you might just want something that you press the button and it works. But there's something out there for all of you. Now, environment and position. I'm just going to talk a bit about video first, and then we'll talk about sort of setting it all up, and then you can have a play with things as well. Video is obviously more complicated. I'm just going to say it is more complicated. There's more stuff to think about, and usually it's better to have two people than one person if you're making video. High-definition camcorders are available now, so the picture will be good. High-definition stuff is good. You will need a tripod. Don't even think about trying to interview someone with a camcorder without a tripod, because if you're 45 minutes an hour... This is a really cheap tripod that costs no more than £25 or £30, I think, and it's fine for just doing that. The second you want to move it in any way, it begins to show its cheapness. And in fact, it's already shown its cheapness by one of the legs coming out the other day, so I've shoved it back in there. So for just recording a person, that kind of works. And obviously you can take the camera off the tripod and move it around as well. You should as well... Now, for sound recording, should you wear headphones? Some people do have an earpiece in when they make a sound recording, just to make sure everything's going well. If it's just me, I always feel having headphones on sort of separates you from the person, and it makes you look a bit odd, and it changes the dynamic of things a bit. When using video, ideally there is your camera operator who also monitors sound coming out of the camera, and then there's someone else asking the questions. That's the ideal setup. Sound is an issue with these setups. You can go out and buy a more expensive camera, which you can connect good microphones to. Oopsie. But with camcorders, there's always an issue about how do you record the sound. This is a relatively expensive camcorder, and you can plug a microphone into it. This is a sort of tie back here. Oopsie. Thank you. You get loads of cable. I'm not going to unwrap it. It plugs in here, and it's mono sound from this microphone. And you can clip that onto someone's lapel, and the sound quality is surprisingly good. It's not professional, but actually it's pretty good. And that works pretty well. However, some people, to get round the problem of not being able to record sound on camcorders, do then record the sound as well on something like this, and marry the two up in the video editing suite, which isn't difficult to do. For long interviews, they go out of sync slightly, but you can adjust that in the edit. So
is that good practice to actually have a recording separate from what
a lot of people do it. It's sort of belt and braces approach, I suppose. So okay. if you're using camcorders, I would say it probably is good practice to use another sound recorder, to be honest. With a more expensive camera, there's no need, because you can clip in high quality microphones and you're fine. Some people may do it as good practice. I'm not sure about that.
May sound a rather naff question, but I mean, what do you aim the camera at? I mean, it sounds like a really silly question.
Funny you should ask that. I'm not going to go into completely the do's and don'ts and nuts and bolts of video totally, because we just simply don't have time. I'll tell you the common mistakes that people do when they use camcorders. Have it at eye level. Okay. If you have it higher or low, then people are looking up or they're looking down. Eye level with the camera. If you have windows behind people, you're in real danger of people getting silhouetted and faces being dark. I don't understand why people don't try and get as much light as possible falling on people's faces. You can see here that these aren't bad at all. Slight darkness. Even when you're indoors with these things, they will work. Did I bring up an example of... Right, I mean, I don't... These are good recordings, but you can see here, poor old Malcolm's in darkness. This is... Shooting indoors with lights is fine. These things will cope, but often you end up with these huge shadows over people's faces. So, light on face. Let's see people's faces with video, I say. Have it at eye level. There are various... I mean, they're all framed nicely. The frame is full. You can see... And I'll go back to the previous one. Another mistake people make is to have the face and the body and the head too small in the frame. The general advice is fill the frame, head and shoulders, close-ups, just but make sure that the frame's fairly full. There's lots of advice, and I think I put on the handout the Media College link. As I say, we haven't got time to go into everything, but there's a really nice website called Media College that goes through the basics of recording interviews. Okay. If you're not sure about framing up a picture, and this goes for stills as well as video, there's a thing called the rule of thirds, which is extremely useful. It's a noughts and crosses board across there. And the way our eyes work with this shape of screen is we kind of like things to be at the intersection points or the third down or a third up. So in all of these, you'll find the eyes are about a third down. There's a bit of headroom, but not too much, just a little bit of headroom. Eyes about a third down. And you always leave, he's talking almost directly to the camera, but when you get this set up, you'll have the interviewer sat here or here. If you have them set over here or over here, the eye line means you're recording a profile, pretty much. So you have people looking just to one side of the camera, and then they have room to speak into. So you always give people room for where they're looking into. Does that make sense? So there's space on that side. If you give people lots of space behind their head, it's that horror movie thing. You kind of expect someone's going to come up and clunk them over the head or something like that. Why is there space behind their head? Why is our attention being drawn to that area? So you tend to give people space where they're looking. So not too much headroom, about a third, space there, and make sure the frame is fairly full. And you won't go too far wrong with just shooting these talking heads.
So you're saying the head shouldn't be in the middle of the frame, it should be slightly to one side?
Slightly to one side. Okay. Generally, people don't shoot straight into the camera, in which case people would be in the middle. Generally, the people are looking slightly off to one side, because you've got the person asking questions.
Right.
I mean, I could do, and I have done this by myself, where I'm sat here like this, and I'm interviewing people like that. I don't enjoy the process, though, because I'm too busy trying to listen and monitor the recording, and it's too much. But you can do that. And you'll see plenty of people on YouTube who have used their iPhones to record interviews out in the field, and that sometimes works extremely well. So it is possible. But this is a more relaxed thing we're talking about here for a lengthy sit-down and recording. Oopsie. I think the other thing when using video is cutaways, things you don't have to worry about with sound at all. There may well be points where someone accidentally jogs the camera or you can't make a very good edit or something like that. So the other thing to remember is to shoot extra footage always with video, whether it's of documents people have referred to or photographs, whether it's when they're not talking but just smiling, getting 30 seconds of someone just smiling at the camera or something along those lines. And you find these are extremely useful for editing. It's a strange thing. If you watch TV, the camera doesn't linger on a talking head for more than 5 seconds before they cut to something. TV is so rapid. And when you do these oral history style things, for a while, it really takes you a while to get used to the fact that we're not cutting away to stuff constantly. Actually, you're going to have to concentrate on what this person is saying. But after a while, you do often feel the need to throw in a photograph or a document or some extra footage. And that's why a lot of people who do video interviews like being in people's living rooms, because they're often family photographs and things set up. So if you have someone with perhaps some of their belongings around them, that sort of sets up the thing quite nicely, and then you can have shots of people looking at their photographs or close-up of photographs and things like that. As I say, there's loads more information that you'll find on the web, and this isn't the place to go into it in any more detail than that. I'll leave the kit out if anyone wants to play with it at any point afterwards. I think those are the main points I would make about video. I think the main mistakes are not enough light on the face and people just framed up badly in a shot so that it doesn't look normal. I say to anyone who's thinking of doing this, go away and have a look at television. Watch television. See how they've done it. See how they frame people up. See how they've edited things together. I will just wave this microphone in the air to demonstrate what I was talking about with XLR cables. The Timex often come in pouches like this, and often have a battery box, and they connect. The battery box is connected by this, which is an XLR cable. That's what it looks like. And if I may snaffle that one, the more expensive recorders take these, that just clips in there, and your high-quality microphone is connected to one of the channels. Why do professionals use these? Well, actually, the cheaper ones can sometimes act like radio aerials, and you are in danger of picking up taxis and things like that. But actually, more often than not, they pick up interference from mains power and things like that. So actually, with the camcorder here, if you use the Timex here, which is not as high quality, it's not balanced, I'm going to get into jargon if I'm not careful, this will always pick up a buzz if you use the mains with this, so you have to use batteries. It's that with this, with the XLR and the more expensive ones, it doesn't matter at all. Also, they're solid, And once they're in, they don't, well, actually, with some of them, they click in and they don't pull out. So they're in there, you won't get loose connections. So for those who it's a living, who use sound as a living or involved with it, you would always use these, the more expensive ones. But for the rest of us, it's not such a pressing issue. Right, you have plenty of time afterwards if you can stick around and play with these. But I think you generally probably all got the idea that you turn them on, the window comes up and there's a red button that says record. With digital recorders, if the sound levels are bobbing up and down, and if the counter's going round, you should be okay. You can monitor them if you want to, but the only problem we've had in our recent project was the memory card appeared to be unformatted or wasn't formatted properly, Dennis was just telling me. And it turned out the user wasn't pressing it in all the way. It wasn't actually a memory card problem at all. But like digital cameras, it's possible that there's something wrong with the memory card. But up to now, I've not come across anything that's gone wrong with these particularly. The one thing I did want to mention, though, was transferring onto the computer. Now, just like cameras, digital cameras, you connect the recorder. No, I haven't got one to wave. Shall I wave this one in the air in a sort of vague way? You put a USB cable in the side, just like it was a camera. You plug it into your computer, turn it on. The computer recognizes it as a portable storage drive, like it would a USB stick or anything like that. You go into, using Windows Explorer or Finder if you're using a Mac, find the files you want, and you can copy and paste, or you can drag and drop, and you put them onto your main hard drive. Once I've had something go wrong with that, and when I went to play the folder, play the file, the sound file, it wouldn't play. It had been corrupted, but I redid the transfer, and it worked fine. The British Library have created a sort of a flow of a workflow for doing this to try and avoid complications with their freelance interviewers. And on pain of death, you are not allowed to delete anything from the recorder until you've transferred it, you've played it back, you've burnt a CD copy that works, and then you can relax and delete it off here, because this, you know, is the backup master, as it were. So, and I think that's good policy, to be honest. I'm sweating at the moment because there's a recorder at the back that has interviews on which I just haven't physically had time to back up, which I may do later today. I'm always nervous until I've copied them and made backups and things like that. Now, in a small community group, unlike the British Library, we don't generally have servers and big computer systems that will back up everything regularly and all the rest of it. You've probably got an ordinary laptop or computer. So how do you archive your stuff? Well, eventually you could archive it with me and the Record Office. But for your own purposes, there's an acronym which I use, which is LOCKSS, L-O-C-K-S-S. And it stands for Lots of Copies Keep Stuff Safe. And that's my digital mantra. Whether it's photographs, documents, sound files, lots of copies keep stuff safe. So I'm currently in negotiations with the university for them to give me a shed load of server space. And in the meantime, I create a CD copy of every interview I do for the person I've interviewed, and then one for me. And I also back it up to two portable hard drives as well, which some people would say is not nearly enough. But there we go. That's what I've got. And I'm hoping I can get it all transferred to a university server where I can just breathe a huge sigh of relief until that huge electrical storm or earthquake comes along and wipes the lot. But we should be okay. So it really is about making copies and just being sure that you are backing things up before you delete the master copy. And there's a certain amount of organisation in the process if there's two or three of you doing the interviews, just to make sure that things do get transferred. You should also think about file names as well. Now, in a museum's context or local authority context, and I've come across this quite a lot, whoever does the oral history project has all the stuff sitting on CDs in a cupboard or on a particular part of the network at the local authority, and then they move on to another job, and then no one knows this stuff exists. And when you go to them and say, could I see your Move In Here collection? They go, we got one. Yes, you have. You did it 10 years ago. Oh, right. Do you know where it is? I say, no, it's your job to know where it is. How do I know where it is? And then you get into these stupid conversations where no one knows where it is. So paperwork is always useful, which we'll come on to, but giving your sound files a sensible file name is also useful. At the British Library, it's something like 24 digits long. The first two digits or letters identify it as an oral history recording rather than a sound recording or wildlife recording or the rest of it. Then you want an accession number. Is it the sort of, you know, the third or the 302nd addition to the collection, and more identifying numbers right through to, is it the master copy, is it a copy edited for public consumption, or is it one that's in the process of being edited? That's why it's that long. Now, I tend to use surnames. I don't know if that's good practice, but I think of these as people rather than numbers. So I generally know that I want the interview with Mrs. Brown or Mr. White or something like that. So I tend to put a surname in as well. But everything gets a unique number.
You might simply ask yourself what you or other people would search for.
What would people search for?
The faintest idea of what you could.
And how does your computer organise stuff as well? Because you might be searching through, how do you want the things to appear when they're organised in Explorer or something like that? But give some thought to file naming. I sometimes get given stuff where it just says Marjorie and Ian. It's no good. It doesn't say what collection it is. It doesn't say anything about it. So at least it tells me Marjorie and Ian are on it, I suppose. There we go. So have a think about that at any rate. Think about the long term and how you're going to store these things. Right. So you've dragged and dropped the sound file, or the video file, indeed, onto your computer. Video takes up, high-definition video takes up loads of space. Think about portable hard drives for backup. You'll have to. It takes up loads of space. On the CDs that I've edited in the past, I try as a rule of thumb not to have anything longer than 3 minutes in one go. My contention being that with editing, you should be able to tell something fairly well within 3 minutes. It doesn't always work out like that. But as I say, I'm more than happy to tighten things up. And I admit quite out that I may well be not representing the pace and flow of how people speak accurately. But I'm thinking of an audience and how the audience is going to listen to it. And am I keeping the audience's attention? Am I moving them through the sort of what I'm trying to communicate in that clip? I don't think anyone who heard anything, if he were to listen back to that, he'd have no problems with it, I'm sure. And he certainly hasn't got in touch with me to tell us he has any problems with it. But I did that to keep the pace, to keep it moving. And of course it sits amongst lots of other tracks on a CD as part of an overall story. This is in many ways the same as editing a book, putting together an exhibition or anything like that. You are always going to make this editing decision about what you take, where you put it. Do you take all of it verbatim, or do you take selections? So there's everything between reproducing it as accurately as you can, right through to sort of just trying to grab the sense of what people are saying. I should say that these are oral sources, so whenever you try and convert them into written text, you're converting them and you're imposing a grammar on them that perhaps didn't exist in the oral source. So generally, it's nice to be able to hear people, because then you're not imposing this written conventions on them. But you may come across, and it's certainly not unheard of, where someone sees their words on the page and says, I sound like a yokel.
Yeah.
Correct my. I want to sound like I'm speaking the Queen's English. I don't want to be presented as a yokel.
Well, it depends who you're doing it for, then, doesn't it?
There's a lot of agendas involved with this. And another example would be, and there was a local historian in Leicestershire who used to do this, which was to try and recreate the local accent. And it's unreadable.
Yeah.
I wouldn't recommend you do that. There may be the occasional thee and thou and thou if you're in Yorkshire or whatever. You might want to do that, but generally you don't try and reproduce phonetically what people are saying. You do, but the actual word order and the way people speak, I would much prefer to keep it as people speak it. Mm. But every project should try and build in time to run things by people and make sure everybody's happy with it. That doesn't always happen. We know this.
We don't speak in written grammar.
No,
we just don't.
No. And you have to be careful when you impose grammar on oral sources to make sure you are actually communicating things the way people intended them to get across. Anyone who's ever done any editing will know this. It's a process, whether it's sound or video or books or whatever. There's no hard and fast, but I suppose the underlying thing is you must represent people properly and respect their wishes generally with these things. With video editing, of course, you've got pictures as well. Now, I haven't got any video editing software on here to show you. But the broad points about video is it's lots more information. if you're using high definition cameras like this, it helps to have a modern computer so that they've got the power to deal with it all. You know, it doesn't have to be super duper. Any modern, relatively well powered, with a good specification laptop or computer should be able to deal with high definition video. You will need specialist software, of course. I don't know if anyone knows if there's any free video editing software out there. Certainly if you get a Mac, you'll have iMovie. I suppose the point I would make about video editing is, if you want to have a go at it yourself, you'll probably get a lot out of it. It's an enjoyable thing to do. It's quite a creative process. But if you're in a project that's going to need to do some video editing and you don't fancy it, then get someone in who does, because it's quite a lot to learn. This is pretty straightforward, I think. But with video, there's more buttons to press. There's more things that you need to know how to do. And there's a whole extra layer with the visuals of things to take into account when you move from one thing to another and chop things out and all the rest of it. And with video, this is why it really pays to have extra shots, extra things you can put in to cover up some of these edits, which isn't usually the case with sound. There's all sorts of good advice available on the internet. There's books you can get. And I'm not really going to say much more about it at the moment. But I suppose I don't want to make it sound too difficult. It is very learnable. And you can have a lot of fun with video. If village trails and all the rest of it, you can use video for this. There's advice out there. There's all sorts of fun to be had with video. It's just that extra layer. And archiving video is really uncertain about formats and will we be able to watch it in 20 years or not. That's a bit of a nightmare.